helpful in these first 11 verses of Hosea chapter 4 to imagine the man standing and looking at events as if they were happening on three stages. On the first stage, he sees a people ignorant of God. In chapter 1, in verse 1, towards the end of the verse, he says, "There is no knowledge of God in the land." In other words, Israel did not know the Lord in a personal and an intimate way, just as Hosea's own wife, Gomer, had failed to know her husband. She had lived with him, she ate his food, she had conversation with him, but she did not know him. And in the same way, Israel was ignorant of God, just as Hosea's wife Gomer was ignorant of her husband. Later on in verse 6, God says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." Ignorance of God destroys both a church and a nation. You understand, of course, that Hosea is not speaking about the absence of religion. You can, in fact, have a great deal of religion along with the ignorance of God. Just because a church is a busy church does not necessarily mean that the people in it are living in the knowledge of God. Hosea is not speaking about the lack of religion, nor is he speaking about the absence of activity. It is a matter of history that Hosea lived in the last days of Israel's golden age. It was a golden age. The shrines were booming. Bethel and Gilgal and Samaria, they were all doing a roaring trade in religiosity. There was plenty going on in the shrines. But Hosea was not fooled. There was no knowledge of God in the land. Now, you don't need to think very hard to see that there is a real comparison between what Hosea saw happening on that stage, stage one, and what we see happening on our stage today. We are now living in a society which is characterized by its ignorance of God. I had a fascinating conversation with a highly educated man recently, and he was telling me what he thought the Bible and Christianity were about. And you would scarcely credit the man's ignorance. He was just about the most misinformed man I have met in years. His basic idea was that there's a little bit of good and a little bit of bad in everybody, and that Jesus had come into this world to bring out the good in every man, because Jesus fundamentally had faith in the goodness of humanity. Now, of course, no one who reads the Bible and no one who reads the Gospels could come away with that view of Jesus. Jesus did not have a fundamental faith in humanity. Jesus distrusted men because he knew what was in man. "Out of the heart of man," said Jesus, "proceed murders," and so on. And Jesus traced the roots of sin and the roots of man's problems not to social circumstances, as sociologists tend to do today, and not to bad housing and unemployment and emotional deprivation. Jesus traced the problems of man to human nature. Man's nature is off the rails with God. Men have gone astray. And therefore our human nature needs to be redeemed. It needs to be purchased back to God. And he viewed his own death as a ransom for sinners and an act of redemption to buy back the lost and the wanderers to God his Father. But this intellectual man I spoke to was completely ignorant of all that. He hadn't read his Bible. He hadn't read the Gospels. And so he had this fuzzy, cotton wool idea of what religion and God and the Gospel were about. And I'm sure the man's ignorance could be multiplied a millionfold. That was what Hosea saw on stage one. A nation that was ignorant of God, religious, interested in experiments in religion, but basically a nation and a society ignorant of the true and the living God. On a second stage, standing in front of that stage, Hosea saw something else. He saw that the sins that were rampant in society were the direct fruits of that ignorance of God. Now, in these first two verses of chapter 4, he mentions two sorts of sin. For example, in verse 1, you find what are sometimes called spiritual sins, or the sins of the heart. Sins of the spirit, sins of our inner attitudes. He says, there is no faithfulness or kindness in the land. Or as we translated that phrase last week, there is no loyalty or mercy. And the loyalty and mercy that Hosea has in mind is a loyalty and mercy along a whole spectrum of activities. It can embrace loyalty within the bonds of marriage. It means the loyalty to your vows. It means loyalty to your employer and his loyalty to you. It means loyalty to Jesus Christ. It means loyalty to the gospel work. It means loyalty to a Christian fellowship. And where you get ignorance of God, you get disloyalty. There is no faithfulness or kindness in the land. Loyalty and mercy tend to disappear. The spiritual sins. But in the second verse, Hosea moves away from these spiritual sins to what we can call the social sins, the evils that are loosed upon society as a whole. And he speaks about swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, men breaking all bounds, and murder following murder. And Hosea's point is that these social sins are also a direct fruit of the ignorance of the true and living God. When men do not know God, then you get swearing and lying and stealing and committing adultery, and these are the order of the day. If, after all, there is no God to whom we have to answer, if there is no judgment, if there is no reckoning, if there is no verdict upon our lives, if our lives are not lived out under the gaze of eternity, why should men not swear and kill and tell lies and steal and commit murder upon murder? Francis Schaeffer pointed out in one of his later books just before he died that when God dies, man dies also. As soon as men say there is no God, they do not simply destroy God, they destroy man, and they turn to the destruction of their fellow man. Principles of humanity die when God dies. Morality dies when God dies. Man himself dies when God dies. Ignorance of God on stage one is responsible for the social sins of swearing and killing and lying and adultery on stage two. Let me ask you, where do you think the present laws on abortion came from? I have spoken to Christian obstetricians who have confessed in private that they see no prospects whatsoever for promotion in the medical profession if they refuse to perform needless abortions. I spoke this week to a man whose son is a doctor. He applied recently for a post in Scotland, and he was questioned by the two other doctors in the practice. And they asked him, "Have you a church connection?" He said, "Yes." They asked, "Are you a Christian?" He said, "Yes." He was asked, "What are your views on abortion?" He said that he could not perform needless abortions because in his view that was the murder of innocent life. "Then we cannot engage you," said the doctors. "Have no fear," said the Christian man. "I could never work with you anyhow." Do you not now know that humanism has consistently stood behind the abortion lobby in Parliament? It was all done and engineered in the name of humanity and the name of compassion and the name of caring. Hosea would have put it like this: where there is ignorance of God on stage one, there is murder upon murder on stage two. I know that statistics vary from time to time, but the present evidence researched by the Society for the Protection of the Unborn Child in Glasgow, along with the CARE organization, C-A-R-E, in London, Mary Whitehouse's group, the present evidence is that tens of thousands of helpless, perfectly healthy, innocent fetuses are aborted every year, and it is all done in the name of humanity and compassion and caring. Compassion for whom? Compassion for the baby? Caring for whom? Caring for the baby? It is all done to appease the great God convenience. The coming child interferes with plans, or interferes with parties, or interferes with foreign holidays. The child must go. My friends, I'm not obsessed with the issue of abortion, but listen to this. Our whole Western society today is reaping in judgment the fruits of that philosophy. Because you see, abortion is not now confined to operating theaters and hospitals. Our whole Western society is run on the abortion principle. Disposable cartons, disposable cups and saucers, disposable clothes made of paper, disposable cutlery made of plastic. If you don't want it, you throw it away. Once you've used it, you throw it away. It's called the abortion principle. Does your marriage bore you? You get rid of it. You abort your marriage. And very soon we shall have divorce possible after a year of marriage. You're tired of your house? You're bored with your car? You abort them. Are you tired of religion? Well, you abort that too. Was your father's religion too oppressive for you? You get rid of that. Do you find the teachings of the Bible just a little bit much for you nowadays? You get rid of them. Is the gospel of Christ too demanding? Well, you dispose of it by changing it. It's the abortion principle. And that abortion principle, throughout the whole of Western society, is the judgment of God on us for our despite of the sanctity of life. In fact, these social sins in verse 2 are taken up by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 5, and they are seen by Jesus as violations of sanctities that are ordained by God and built into the very fabric of the universe. You see, murder is a violation of the sanctity of a life that is made in the image of God. Abortion is all right if man is not made in the image of God. But murder is a violation of that sanctity. Lying is a violation of the sanctity of truth. Stealing is a violation of the sanctity of property. Adultery is a violation of the sanctity of marriage. You see, friends, you cannot interfere with these basic sanctities of life and truth and marriage and property and so on without interfering with the very stuff of the universe. You're dabbling with the very stuff of the universe. You're changing the fabric of the universe. Because God has built them into the universe and into the life of man. You cannot interfere with them without wrecking society. And so in front of a stage on which Hosea sees a nation that is living in ignorance of God, he sees a nation on another stage that is falling to pieces. Social sins that are the fruit of ignorance. But Hosea also sees a third stage. And this is really how to understand verses 4 onwards, where God summons the people to a trial. Let no one contend and let none accuse. You see, he now goes beyond society with its sins and beyond society with its ignorance of God. And he asks the question, is there more to the story than this? Or is this just the whole story, that when men are ignorant of God, society falls to pieces? Is there not another truth beyond this? And he asks the question, well, who is to blame for the ignorance of God in a land? Well, who would you say is to blame for the ignorance of God? I suppose one could blame the home situation, because the family is a unit of life, and the family has tended to fall apart since the end of the Second World War. There has been a breakdown in discipline in families. Someone has said that many homes today are little more than restaurants and dormitories, where people pop in to have a meal occasionally, and where people go to bed. You eat there and you sleep there, but you don't live there. You live somewhere else. You live in the theatre or the cinema or the discotheque or the bingo hall. That's where life is. In the home, well, it's just a restaurant. You have a meal. It's a dormitory, so that's where you sleep. And discipline has fallen apart, so I suppose you could blame home life and the disintegration of family life. You could blame secularism in the schools, by which I mean the non-existence of religious teaching in many schools. One young lad of 12 this week was telling me about the religious instruction he gets in school. He is consistently taught by his teacher that the Bible is a collection of fairy tales and Middle Eastern mythologies. Scorn is poured by him on the miracles of Christ, and events such as the Exodus are all explained away. I wouldn't mind a teacher teaching these things if he was in a private school. But this man is being paid by the state to teach this nonsense, and it's all taught in the name of religious instruction.
In fact, many teachers don't teach religious instruction at all. They teach civics or politics, especially left-wing politics, or social studies. I'm becoming more and more convinced that the basic underlying philosophy of our day is humanism. Humanists are dictating what happens in the worlds of education and of medicine and of morality. You see, humanism teaches that man is a self-contained unit. All that man ever needs is to be found in his own nature. There is nothing outside man's nature to come in and help him. There is no God outside man to come in and help. There is no savior apart from man himself. And the only deliverance that a man can hope to find is deliverance that is found within man himself. Now that is classical humanism. All life can be explained in human terms because man is the beginning and the end of all life. And if a man feels that he needs to be saved, then he's got to save himself, because there is no other savior than man. If humanism stands behind what is taught in many schools, will you blame the schools as well as the home for the sins of society and the ignorance of God? Hosea looks beyond the ignorance of God to a third stage, and he doesn't speak about the home or the school. He speaks about the priest and the prophet, and they are the men who are behind the ignorance of God. Verse 4, with you is my contention, O priest. Verse 5, the prophet also will stumble with you. Verse 6, I reject you from being a priest to me. Verse 7, speaking to the prophet, you have forgotten the law of God. Hosea says the priest and the prophet are responsible for the ignorance of God in the land. Well, what are the counterparts of these two men today? Well, it's essential to see that priests and prophets were men who stood between God and man. The priest stood between God and man as a mediator. He was a middleman between God and man. And his job was to bring man to God in prayer. The prophet also stood between God and man, but he brought God to man in the message and in the word. Hear the word of the Lord. And that's what stands at the heart of these two offices. The priest brought man to God in prayer, and the prophet brought God to man in the word. The priest's ministry was intercessory. He took men into his prayers, and he brought men to God. The prophet's ministry was declaratory. He started with God and what he had to say, and he brought God down to men in the word. And Hosea says, it's the priests and the prophets who are responsible for the ignorance of God. It's the prayers and the preachers who are responsible for the ignorance of God. Because when prayer dies out in a church, and when the prayers die out in a church, not only does the church die, the society round about it dies. And the death of today's society is due to the failure of Christians to pray. When the voice of prayer dies in the church, the priestly voice, and when prophetic ministry dies in the church, a prophetic voice telling the world who God is and what He's done, His mighty acts, His counsels. When the priestly voice and the prophetic voice die, when prayer and preaching die, not only does the church die, but the society round it dies, because behind the ignorance of God, there is the failure of the prayer and the preacher. But when priest and prophet function properly, and when prayer and preaching are given the right place in the Christian church, the church is a healthy church and a sound church and an alive church. But when prayer and preaching die, when they are silent, then the church and the people round about it all die. I spoke to a young minister a few years ago, and he had gone to his first charge, and nothing much was happening, I think largely because he was soft-peddling the gospel. And he came to see me, and we spoke about things, and in the course of the conversation he said, "But Mr. Swanston, I'm feared to tell them. He was afraid to hurt people, you see. He's afraid to shock them, afraid to waken them up, afraid to make them sit up, take notice. He says, "I'm feared to tell them." "Well," I said, "if you don't do it, who's going to do it? You will leave your parish and someone else will need to come in and start where you should have started. Somebody's got to start somewhere. And that other man will have to die the death. And he'll have to come in and be crucified, because you hadn't the courage to stand up and tell the truth. If you don't do it, somebody else will have to do it." Oh, friends, a prayerless church is a dead church. A prayerless churchman is a dead churchman. A prayerless ministry is a dead ministry. A prayerless man is a dead man. He's not a Christian at all. He shouldn't call himself a Christian. It's hypocritical of him to call himself a Christian. A Christian is somebody who prays. He speaks to God, not necessarily in high-flown ecclesiastical churchy language. But a Christian is a man who speaks to God. Do you speak to God? A prayerless man is a dead man. And a church without prophecy and without prophetic ministry and declaratory ministry, and that's not just what I'm doing, but what you're called to do, is a dead church. Hosea says later on, where is it? Verse 9. It's one of the most profound things he ever said. "Like people, like priest." In other words, society is a reflection of the state of the church. Like people, like priest. Oh, what a challenge. And what an invitation this is to us today. And what a hope, looking at it positively. What a hope towards the changing of our society. Do you want the swearing and the killing and the stealing and the murders and the lies to stop? Prayer and preaching are the way. That stands on the third stage. What a challenge. What an invitation. Psalm 2 says, "Ask of me, and I will give you the heathen for your heritage." Ask
of me, and I will give you. Paul says, it's the climax of the armor in Ephesians 6, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit. And that's the seventh item in the armor of the Christian, the weapon of all prayer. Prayer's not a thing that you sell a tape on, a kind of extra, kind of optional extra. Oh, you can go in for this if you're very religious or very devout or very pious. You can go in for prayer. Paul says it's the seventh crucial item in the gospel armor, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit. First and last, beyond the sins of society and beyond the ignorance of God, if it's got to change, first and last, priest and prophet, prayer and preaching. Amen. May God add a blessing to his word, to his name be honor and praise. 366, which has been asked for, we rest on thee, our shield and our defender. I think the tune is Finlandia, Jeffrey? Yes. 366.